nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So is closed book better or more difficult question with open book better? Closed book is good, right? Yeah. The first time I came to America, the first quantum mechanics course is in 1989. And the professor said, open book exam. I said, I'm from Bangladesh, so never had an open book exam. I thought, this professor must be crazy. Open book exam? I will copy all the answers from the book. Of course, you open the first question and then you realize that if you try to look in the book for the answer, you are not going to answer anything. So there is a trick of open book exam, right?
Usually, why?
Because you cannot answer even if the book is open.
Yes.
So we'll get started then. Today, this is the third lecture on measurement, making high precision measurements. And today we'll be talking about spin-dependent recombination. If you remember the big picture, is we are thinking about a set of reliability issues like NBTI, hot carrier degradation, and each one of them requires precision measurements because you will be measuring small quantities at a very short time. Now, the techniques that I have discussed so far includes capacitance voltage characteristics, on-the-fly method, charge pumping, and there was DCIV method. Now, these methods are all very sophisticated, and the one that I'm going to talk about today is one of the most advanced. In an industrial setting, if you work, you may not be able to use them all. But the five or six material techniques that I have described or explained to you today are in this last three lectures. If you understand them, then there is nothing else, no other technique that you need to worry about that you will not understand. So therefore, because it involves everything, it involves charge in the capacitance voltage characteristics, it involves electron flux, charge pumping, electron filling in trap levels and emptying trap levels, DCIV similar. And today, I'm going to talk about spin-dependent recombination. That is the only thing you have left. There's nothing left, right? You have charge, flux, and spin. And so this is one of the most advanced techniques. But there are limitations, you will see. This is a slow method. And so there'll be relaxation. So I have a set of topics to discuss. I'll begin with the electron spin resonance. This is something I recorded already as a supplementary material. I'll go through that quickly to remind you to set it up for this spin-dependent recombination. You can view this spin-dependent recombination like a charge pumping, but not really. This is somehow related to, but this is a flux-based method, and we'll see how it works. The most important reason we want to look at this is because charge pumping does not tell you that exactly which specific form of atomic defects are involved, because all of them, so long they can contribute to current, charge pumping doesn't care. It will not tell you that it is looking in 2-1-1 direction. Or 1-1-0 direction, or it is a E prime center very close to the interface versus a PB center exactly at the interface. This distinction cannot be made by charge pumping because this distinction is important because your solution strategy for improving the process, if it's an E prime center, you will have overpressure of oxygen. That's how you are going to fix it. If it's a PB center, it is going to be hydrogen passivation, completely different technique. So charge pumping cannot distinguish between these, whereas spin-dependent systems can. And that's why this is an additional complementary measurement that you would like to do. I'll tell you a little bit about the very beautiful recent experiments that are coming out that you should be able to understand. This is related to noise. And this noise, how it gets affected in the presence of spin-dependent recombination. And once I explain that, then I will conclude. You remember the basic setup that we generally, anytime we want to explore a particular phenomena, be it hot carrier or NBTI, then we said that we want to measure them periodically. And the idea was that when you want to measure them periodically, you stop at these ELO points, and it takes a certain amount of time before you do the measurement. So therefore, anytime you stop, of course, there is a penalty, and especially for NBTI, you have to be careful that you don't pay too much of a penalty, because otherwise it will not be a very good measurement. But for many other systems, if you take a little bit longer, then it doesn't matter. Charge pumping belongs to that category. Subthreshold slope method belongs to that category. And today's spin-dependent recombination certainly belongs to that category, because you have to stop, turn on the magnetic field, turn on the, rearrange the voltages, make a measurement, go back and stress again. So this is, in that sense, a slow method, but will give you a wealth of information that you cannot get from any other technique, not CV, not cell. None of these techniques will give you what spin-dependent recombination, SDR, is an aggregation, what that can give you. Remember the idea. The idea is that we have a single spin. You see the blue balloon, which is an unpaired silicon electron. This is silicon-silicon dioxide interface. There is three silicon atoms holding the silicon back, and the fourth neighbor is missing at the silicon-silicon dioxide interface. And we have said that that's like a PB center. You have an unpaired electron. This is very important, because the unpaired electron can either look up or it can look down with respect to a magnetic field. If you don't have any magnetic field, there's no preferred orientation. But once you have a magnetic field, there is a preferred orientation. And you can compare between PB0 that is shown in the middle with the red oxygen atoms, and you can see the white balloon looking at a slightly different angle compared to a vertical one. So in that case, when you have a magnetic field and you change the orientation of the magnetic field, it will simply by looking at which point the recombination is maximum, you can distinguish between which direction the unpaired electron was looking at in the beginning. And similarly for the E prime centers and all. So previously, when I had a defect, I said that you can store a charge. That's the basis of the capacitance voltage characteristics. You can pump a charge from here down here. That's charge pumping, right? You put something in, put something back. The extra information now is that with a magnetic field, if you polarize the spin of this electron in a particular direction, only the opposite one now can come down. The one that is together, they cannot come down anymore. This is the extra piece. So therefore, you can orient it in a particular direction and thereby control with the magnetic field the Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination time. That is the basis of this technique, essentially the basis of the technique. Now, what is it that you could not do with ESR? ESR, remember, is not a measurement, is not electrical. You shine, let me explain, maybe that will become clear. So important to distinguish between these techniques. What ESR can and cannot do, I will explain in the next slide. You remember that there are lots of different types of defects in the system. For example, the PB centers, which are in the middle, shown here as an unpaired electron, or the second one in here, you can see this. And the rest of the ones are either bonded to oxygen or they are bonded to hydrogen, not unpaired. You have all these variants of E prime center. You remember E prime, right? E prime centers are broken silicon oxygen bonds. So there are variants of it, depending on how they are locally bonded and all. When you shine an ESR signal, and which is I'm going to show you next, it is going to detect all of them. As you change your magnetic field, different one will come into resonance at different time, so you will be able to pick them up all. But which one of them is electrically relevant? This will not tell you. Because that level, which one, let's say you have a PV center, its level is way up from the conduction band. It has no relevance for electrical characteristics, because nothing can go in and get out. ESR method will not be able to tell you which is inside the band gap and which is not. And that is the main limitation of the technique. It tells you a lot of information about spin. but doesn't anchor it with respect to the conduction and valence band, and therefore may not be electrically relevant. What is the basic idea? Just a quick reminder in a 3-4 slides. The basic idea was that there was a variable DC field. Variable meaning you put it in a magnet, and then inside the magnet gradually crank up the current, and the current translates to magnetic field. So you have a DC magnetic field, but most of the time you will have a very slow envelope on top of it, like a kilohertz or so, very slow, because then you can lock in on the other side. Otherwise, there's just too much noise in the system. These are very precision measurements. And then you have a 10 gigahertz microwave, 9.3 to be precise. This is an AC, and it is fixed. That magnetic field is a small signal, and that's not changing. DC is changing, AC is fixed. And then you look at the absorption spectra, that at which point, remember all these defects that I just explained to you in the previous slide, in one, which one comes in resonance? Of course, as you pointed out when I discussed this before, that a priori you have a set of resonances, but which one belongs to E prime, which one belongs to PB, that requires theory. Somebody has to independently calculate a theoretical peak, absorption peak, and then align with the experiment one, thereby get the interpretation. There's no a priori way to say that, okay, that peak is there, the PB center is what? 2.001. That's the PB center. E prime center is what? 2.006, right? That's the E prime center. 2006 and 2001. This is how I remember. So in, yes.
Question. Is there is a physical interpretation? We could say that this should be larger than the free electron and the other one smaller than the free electron. Is there something to say there?
Not even that. Not even that. Because even I have seen some of these systems in which it is 1.995, and people generally discuss the meaning of this and how it could happen. But free electron is 2, absolutely 2 to 9 decimal places. This is one of the highest precision measurement in physics. There is no deviation from 9th, is even then it's not away from 0. The 9th one, there's a debate whether this is 0. But even on the 9th one, this is absolutely the same. The idea is, you remember, that generally we look at the absorption signal, and the signal has a peak, and what you do, you take a derivative, and the derivative is what is plotted. In many papers, when you read it, you will see the derivative plotted, but they'll call it signal. It's not really signal, because there'll be many ups and downs, and the derivative essentially picks up the peaks. And so therefore, its derivative is what is typically plotted. Don't get confused by the word signals. Signal is not. That's what the experimentalist did. This is the signal. So you have defect 1, defect 2, and defect 3, but none of them is saying where the level is. None of them are saying that whether they'll be relevant for any experiment. Electrically relevant degradation process. Hot carrier, does any of them matter? You cannot tell a priori. And you remember the simple relationship that H nu is that 10 gigahertz, right? That's the frequency, 10 gigahertz microwave frequency. And you know the value of B by looking at this inflection point that gives you the value of B. Mu is known, right? Value of mu is well known. And G is the factor. Deviation from 2 is what you're trying to calculate. Now, the point is that why is it away from 2? And it's again a review. I have already discussed this before. You can think about this in an absolute layman's term, in a high school version of things, that the proton is the red proton is like the sun. And the black electron on the left plot is the like a planet. If you are sitting on the planet, however, it will look like sun is going around you. And so correspondingly to the second picture, what I have seen is put the earth in the center, this, and you are sitting on the earth, and you can see the red sun is going around you. Now, proton is a charge, right? It's a charged particle. And therefore, anytime a charge goes around, what does it mean? It means there's a current. So you can think about the orbit of the sun. Sun, real sun is charge neutral, presumably. This proton sun is then is a charged particle going around. So you have a current loop, and that current loop produces the red magnetic field. You remember this law, the red magnetic field, red arrow looking up, that's coming from the interaction with the proton, right? So this is called a spin orbit interaction. What is the original spin? The electron has the red arrow looking slightly tilted. That is electron's own spin, which is spin half. And then the red one is the due to the angular momentum associated with the proton. That's where the word spin orbit coupling comes from. There is an orbit. Looks around as if it is the sun is going around you. And once you have that, depending on how many protons you have, the interaction will be different. If you have three silicons as your neighbor, then the interaction will be slightly different than if you had two oxygen and one silicon in the neighbor. Why? Because the number of protons in each one of them is slightly different. So therefore, the red sun is for one proton. But if you have different combination of proton going around in different orbits around surrounding you, then you can easily see that you will have a net magnetic field which will be slightly different. And so that gives rise to this splitting of the original one. The electron originally on its own, the atom on its own, let's say hydrogen atom, it would have been a 2p, but because of the neighboring magnetic fields, you will have a certain amount of splitting. And so in the absence of the DC magnetic field, again, I'm plotting the DC here. In the absence of it, let's say you have this red one and the blue one, there is a certain amount of splitting. Why? Because the neighbors have already created a surrounding magnetic field. Even when you have not applied any magnetic field, the neighbors have one. So there is already a splitting. And the electron would prefer to sit in the bottom level because you have one electron and it always prefers the lower energy level. You apply the DC magnetic field from outside. And when you do that, it splits the level up. This one keeps going down. This one keeps going up. And so what will happen, these electrons will prefer to stay on the bottom row, especially if your temperature is low, will prefer to stay on the bottom row. However, when the 10 gigahertz signal is in resonance, so then what will happen exactly at resonance, then there will be constant splitting. It will go up by absorbing the quanta of 10 gigahertz. It will come down by emitting a 10 gigahertz quanta. Up, down, up, down. So that's where the resonance comes from. Right? It's like a child. When you swing the child in a resonance, then you have the maximum amplitude because the energy transfer is the maximum. When you go away from that, go away from the magnetic field, of course it cannot catch the upper level anymore. No more resonance. So that's the basic picture. So you know how it works. And from that, of course, you look at all these different signatures. Remember, these are all derivative, right? You remember? And then from those, you can correspondingly assign levels. So let me stop here on this particular one because I want to explain something more. Okay. So let's now talk about spin-dependent recombination. And you understand the problem. The problem is electrical relevance of the previous measurement is not known. So that's what I want to do. So now, so the point I wanted to make before was that now with the external magnetic field, you will align the spin, existing spin. This is the PB center. This is a PB center, let's say it's a PB center, or it could be E prime, but remember the E prime will be farther down inside the oxide. And so therefore it will not participate in the recombination. Just like charge pumping or DCIV, the things that are closer to the silicon-silicon dioxide interface, only those will contribute. So you can immediately see, only when it is electrically active, only those spins will play a role. The ones which are not electrically active, they don't. You don't have any information of those things in here. And which one will come down if you had two electrons? Remember in the conduction band, we always multiply it with a factor of two. We calculate the density of state and then multiply the factor of two to account for the spin. This is the black spin and the red spin. and you can see the red spin will come down. That can come in here because you have, remember, it's a single level. So only the opposite spin can come down, but the black one will be prevented from coming down. So we'll see by aligning this more and more, if we have making it all aligned up, we'll be able to control what is the Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination through this process. And thereby, we'll understand how many defects I have and essentially at what energy level. Again, the experiment is similar. What I said 10 gigahertz before, it's 9.4 really, 9.4 gigahertz. You have the DC field. What are the two new things? One is that electrically connected now, right? Previously, I had a absorption transmission. I just probe the transmission. Now I have an electrical connection. I don't have any optical detection, optical or microwave detection. Second, do you see on the corner, what is it? We have light. Previously, I didn't have light. So these are the two things that are different. And then that creates all sorts of interesting things, as you'll see. Now assume that you want to calculate, just like a normal semiconductor, a normal, let's say, n-type, p-type, intrinsic, whatever, semiconductor. If you wanted to calculate how many electrons you have on the conduction band following shining of light, what would you do? You will write, there's no diffusion term, no drift term, because this is a uniform sample. You will write a generation term, and you will write a recombination term. And in steady state, you set it to zero. And you can immediately see the tau sub B, I'll explain it a little bit, B is a function of magnetic field. Even at zero field, would you have some recombination? Certainly. The spontaneous emission, this direct recombination, you will certainly have that. And that's the sigma NITV. This would be there, or Shockley-Reed-Hall, it will be there even if you didn't have any magnetic field. What the magnetic field will do is effectively change this sigma, I'll show you, effectively. And so, therefore, what you can do is that, so delta N, steady state, will be G, whatever is the generation, multiplied by the recombination time. If your recombination time is long, then you will have large delta N, because it cannot recombine yet. And if you wanted to look at the current before turning on the magnetic field and after turning on the magnetic field, then you will see this is proportional, this would be proportional to the magnetic field itself. So from that, you can back calculate how many NIT you have and where do you have it, right? So it's essentially a conductivity measurement. You shine light, you crank up the magnetic field, and then what you will see periodically is your recombination going down. And then from that resonance, you find out how many defects you have, electrically relevant defects you have. And it will show that if you look at the change in the resistance, because the V is essentially constant, delta G over delta V, or delta V over delta J, if you look at the resistance, there'll be a peak. And when there's a resonance, I'll show you where it comes from. And experimentally, that's what people see. Do you see one important thing? 300K, it's a room temperature measurement. The previous one, most of the time, are done at low temperature. So this is a much more robust measurement with this respect. Now, this is the original theory, how it came about. Turns out the theory is a little bit more complicated. I want to explain that to you. But the idea is essentially this. I want to explain why this B dependence, where it comes from. And after this, you will never think about Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination as simply as you did in 606. I tell you often in 606, that I'm cheating left and right. This is one of the cheating that went on, which you being innocent really didn't really know or realize. This is what goes on in a Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination. So let me explain. Let's focus on there are these extra things. Ignore those. Let's focus on this. I have light coming in with H bun nu, taking an electron from the conduction band, from the valence band to the conduction band. Now, typically, if you have a Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination, let's say you have it at level S0, what I'm calling S0, you'd have an electron coming down from the top conduction band and waiting here to recombine with a hole, and you say, you calculate that rate, you're done. You say, I can go home, I can done, I have learned much. Actually, a much more complicated process actually goes on. This word S-naught has to do with this spin levels, which I'm going to go through in the next four slides in some detail. In fact, what happens immediately after recombination, when the electron comes down, on the left-hand side, I'm showing you two cones, ice cream cones. And what you should see, I have two arrows, one arrow looking on the left and one arrow looking to the right. This is the first arrow is the original electron in the PB center looking up. This second arrow is a new electron which just landed and together formed a pair. This is S equals zero. Net spin is zero because they are diametrically opposite. When you have two vectors diametrically opposite, what is the net result? Zero. Also, the Z component along the magnetic field is also zero because if you take a Z projection and then sum, that will be zero also. This state is called S0. This is sort of the ground state. Then what will happen, by the way, the length of this vector, how much? You know the rule, SS plus 1. It is half, so half plus 3 halves and the square root of that. That is where the square root of 3.2 comes from. How much is the square root of 3.2? 0.87 or so. This is 0.87. And the vertical is half. All right. Then what happens? That there are this set of states at S1 and T1. This is called triplet state. This is singlet state. Electron, in fact, before even recombining, they immediately jump up to S1 level and then split to that. Triplet state, and I will explain that also. Don't worry about it. I'll explain also. They jump transition here. This transition is critical because once they do transition here, the Shockley-Hall recombination is forbidden from the triplet to here. From S1 to S0, it is, I'll explain what these things are. S1 to S0 is allowed. So if you can directly come down, then it can catch a hole and recombination can complete. On the other hand, if it goes to these triplet states, then it takes forever for it to come. That's why Shockley-Hall lifetime is so long. This level, the spacing between them, you can control by magnetic field. And what you can do by changing the spacing by the DC magnetic field and the AC magnetic field will create a resonance, allowing the electron to transfer faster. And therefore, you can change the Shockley-Hall time constant. So this is the goal, right? So the whole point is that generally it will go from S0 to S1. S1 to it could directly come to S0, or from S1 it could go to the triplet, and then stays there forever before coming down. Shockley-Hall combines the whole process into one value. On the other hand, by using the magnetic field, you can split the levels and thereby control the Shockley-Hall lifetime. And from that, you can calculate. Remember, this is all related to the PB center defects I had. If I didn't have any PB center defect, this picture doesn't exist. And so, therefore, that is what will be the controlling factor. I saw a hand somewhere. Yes.
My question is why this arrow, what she goes from this node to this
node? I'll explain everything. I have nice pictures. So it will. So the S equals one level. So this triplet T1 and S1, these all belong to S equals 1 level. On the top, what you see is the both cones looking up, right? Do you see that? Here, the two cones were looking down, opposite, S0. On that one, both cones looking up. And in that case, the perpendicular projection, so you have two vectors. Do you see two half vectors? And the big arrow is the corresponding the total value. This is the second one. So I'm trying to explain to you the origin of this various levels. Then you have T equals zero state where the perpendicular projection is zero. Do you see how this works? So now instead of being diametrically opposite, which had S equals zero, now you have things like this. So now you have a Z component is zero. Because you have Z component here, you have Z component on this side. Z component is zero, but the net vector is no longer zero. net vector is 1 because you have a trapezoidal rule. From here, net vector is 1 parallel to this direction. And similarly, it could look down. So if the both spins look down, then you have s equals 1 and the z component projected is equal to minus 1 because the vector is looking down. If the both spins are looking up, then that's the ms equals plus 1. And then value, s value is 1. And of course, if one is looking up, the other is looking down, but not in the diametrically opposite center, then that will be ms equals 0. This is called t0. This is called t minus 1. That will be called t plus 1. And we'll see how the population goes around on this one. So those are the names of the structure. Yes.
Can I ask why those cones are,
you know,
kind of in that way, and
you know,
how we are moving between them?
No, you cannot ask me that question. That question, I can either put it, it's a good question, that why is it like this? That question requires that one takes a quantum mechanics course, or one, I'll post this, maybe a few slides. You can take a look.
Going from one state to other, is it through scattering or something?
The scattering?
Yeah.
It will come. Wait. Everything will be, the story will be shown. So it is another view of this picture. So what happens that when the electron, either you can do it by photo excitation or the energy the electron had when it came from the conduction band and dropped into the trap level, that energy was given, right? That makes it jump from S0 to S1. S0 to S1. S0 is a slightly squashed cone, and then S1 is a slightly, it's a higher level, slightly elongated cone, because the higher, the smaller the radius is, more energetic it is, right? That's S1. You can think about it as like another quantized level. Then you have two electrons. Now you cannot distinguish between the electrons. So the electron, one could be up, the other could be down, or they could exchange places. So you'll have a parallel combination, alpha beta plus beta alpha. Alpha is the electron looking up, beta is the electron looking down. You can have that combination. What is that level? T0. T0 level, right? It doesn't have a Z component. Z component is equal to 0. And T1 level is that? Okay. So you can see from S1 to T0, it's very easy to transfer. That is something called inter-system coupling. Why? Do you see this? Why? Because all the second spin has to do is to rotate slightly faster. Previously, they were diametrically opposite. If the bottom one rotates a little bit faster, then it will come and get into that system, the second system. Do you understand this? From here, if this one rotated a little bit faster with respect to the other one, at some point, they will align to this level. Once it is aligned in this level, S equals 1, then it can transfer to the neighbors. It can transfer to the neighbors because they, in that case, the total spin is conserved because all three have S equals 1, the capital S equals 1. Only then the transfer is possible. You first have to go from here to this point by inter-cellular system coupling. From here, because the total S is the same, you can either go here or you can go here. But you cannot jump from here to here. You always have to go through this particular one. And once you are here, it becomes very difficult for it to come down to this recombination, original plane, and complete the Shockley-Reed-Hall recombination process. By the way, this original one is also looking in the opposite direction. So what is the difference between T1 and T0? This is comes with a negative sign. The other one will have the positive sign. If you have taken a quantum mechanics course, I think this should be easy to follow. If not, don't worry about it. Just remember the level goes from S0 to S1, and from S1 to it goes to T0, and from T0 it can either go to T1 plus or T1 minus, and then it can come back. Just understand up to this far, this should be fine. If you have taken a quantum mechanics course, this should become, you will understand in a deeper level what is happening. So these are the rules. And whatever I said to you before, this is the sort of summary. step one or point one, S0 to S1 transition is possible. It can jump up or it can jump down. You see from there, from that diagram. S1 to T10 transition is possible. That's the inter-system coupling, right? And then the selection rule says that you can only jump to the neighbors. You cannot jump through two levels at the same time. So that is that delta SZ must be plus minus one. So you cannot go from T1 plus to T1 minus because that will be two levels, jumping two levels, not allowed. And then coupling to T1 plus to S0 is similar to T1 minus to S0 because they are the same. In one case, both of them are looking down. The other case, both of them are looking up. So they, wave function wise, they're exactly the same. And so therefore, this coupling, T10 to S0 or T1 minus S0, exactly the same. But T10 to S0 is different. Because in that case, their wave vectors are not exactly, the wave function is different. So therefore, just take a look at the previous slide where I wrote down the wave function. You can immediately convince yourself that this has to be the case. And the splitting with the magnetic field, which I'll explain next, between T10 and T1 plus is not the same as T10, T1 minus and T10. So the two levels are not exactly the same. I'll just write here. This T10, T1, let's say plus 1, T1 minus 1. What I'm trying to say, this gap is slightly different than this gap. Therefore, magnetic field, the AC magnetic field, will only couple to one or the other, but not to both simultaneously. Of course, you could change the AC magnetic field strength, or if you increase the DC magnetic field or decreased it so that this level becomes smaller. Remember, this spacing depends on the magnetic field, strength of the DC magnetic field. And so if you reduced it, of course, this one could become in resonance. But at a given time, for a given DC field and a given AC value, AC amplitude, only one of the pair will interact.
Question.
Yes.
The energy in this transition, how it's like it absorbs a phonon or like...
No, but remember the electron was in the conduction band.
Okay.
When it dropped down, it liberated a lot of energy.
Okay. And then this energy will contribute all these...
All these processes.
Okay.
Yeah. This is, by the way, photosynthesis. Every time you see a leaf, this is the mechanics of singlet-triplet transition that goes on. If you understand this one, then you'll have some idea about photosynthesis, that this is the transition people often talk about. By the way, the spacing, beta DC, will control it. And then at one point, one of them will come in resonance, and then everything will be done. All right, so let's write some equations. We like equations, so let's write equations. So dne dt, I'm trying to calculate. At the end of the day, I'm trying to see how many electrons are in the conduction band as a function of the magnetic field. Because from that, I can calculate the conductivity of the sample. If I have no electron, immediately Shockley-Riddle recombination, no electron left, low conductivity. If I could shut down the entire recombination completely, I will have a lot of conductivity because Ne, which is the free electron on the conduction band, those will pile up. So the conductivity will go down. This is what the essence of the math is. Math is simple. It's a simple algebra. So I'm looking at the number of electrons. What are the important things? Generation is G, number of electrons that are going up. Remember, this is coming from where? Photons. The strength of the photon will control G. Sigma Ne S naught, that will be the recombination, direct recombination through the traps. RNe is a direct recombination, band-to-band direct recombination in silicon, minuscule. Generally in minuscule, the other one is the trap-state recombination. Now, if you wanted to say how many of them are in the T1 state, T10 state, T1 plus state, T1 minus state, the three states, then you can write the corresponding equations. You can say whoever came down, look at the middle term, look at the middle term here. This was the number that jumped down here, was lost from the conduction band. So I looked at it as a lost term for the free electrons. One third of them jumped here. One third of them will jump to the next one, and one third of them will jump to the third, because it will split into three triplet states, right? They will get equal contribution. N plus R, what is that? It is direct recombination. N plus R is a direct recombination. N plus to N0, that is the transfer between them from plus to zero. And N plus to N minus multiplied by B, that's the corresponding magnetic field induced. I have to check whether it's N minus, I think so. And that will be proportional to the magnetic field, because if the magnetic field essentially resonates between these two, then that will transfer things. That's how I've written it. But it could, you could write it in terms of this or in terms of this also. No problem. For T0 state, again, getting one third of the total, right? Because there are three people, you have to divide whatever you have in three of them. Correspondingly, spontaneous recombination you have. N0 to N plus, this is the transition between them, spontaneous transition. And N0 to N minus, there's another spontaneous transition. Because it can just transfer between the neighbors easily. And the rate is W. The rate is W. I don't have a B term. Why not? Because the B has already resonated with that one. And so therefore, I do not have a corresponding B term here. And similarly, finally, in the N minus, again, one third of this spontaneous recombination. I think I have a mistake here. I'll check this particular term. But this is the transition between the neighbors. You solve these three equations. Yes.
Why do you use double in proportion?
W.
You just said that they are not exactly the same.
They are not?
Transition between T1, 0 and
T1. No. Remember that this one is talking to the magnetic field. But in the absence of a magnetic field, transition between them will be the same, because they're essentially all three at the same level. So what you will see that these are very small terms anyway. The main important thing is the B term. If you didn't have a magnetic field, then this becomes important. And if you don't have a B term, then all three levels are exactly energetically, they are exactly in the same level. So therefore, transferring between them will always be W, as you want to transfer spontaneously from one level to the other. But in the presence of a magnetic field, they are in different energy. So you are right. In that case, I should not have just written a P or W, because transition from top to bottom versus bottom to top has a plus one, extra factor of plus one. Right.
So what was W?
Pardon me?
What was W? Energy between
them? No, W is a transition rate, spontaneous transition rate. Between the levels. You set this equal to zero, steady state. And then you solve this equation. The NT is a total number, N0, N plus, N minus. I'm just solving this by setting it to equal to zero. And I want to calculate that what that FB is. And you can see it's very easy, because you just solve the three equations. It has a bunch of terms. You can see all the W's floating around. The spontaneous emission, R naught, all those things. But the important point is that there is a B-dependent term. If there is a B-dependent term, therefore, as a whole, this FB will be different. So the total number of traps which are at a given excited state, that number will be dependent on B, the magnetic field, because magnetic field will couple the levels. You solve that equation, and then you can, just solve this three equations, setting it to zero. Generation rate is now, you can see this, if you didn't have any B or any of these terms, this would be small, but you have this direct recombination term, right? RNE, spontaneous emission, direct recombination. But because of the B, then what will happen, that this term, the first term, will keep changing. And when you solve for any, remember G is given, that's my light photon, number of photons that came in. When I solve for any, then that will be B dependent. And this any, therefore, will be measured in the output circuit as a conductivity of the sample. And that will change as a function of B. And this one contains in it the number of defects you have. Yes, so this NS0, the corresponding one, this has the number of defects you have. If you would have it equal to zero if you didn't have any traps. And so essentially, this is how one would look at the change in the resistance. And only, I just want to go back one step. This resonance will happen, N plus to N minus resonance will happen only when the DC splitting of the levels matches with the AC splitting. If you don't have that matching, this last term on the first equation will be equal to zero because there is no magnetic field interaction associated with it. So this is where all the physics is. All the spin-dependent recombination, you are controlling the Shockley-Reid-Hall recombination by controlling essentially the recombination through the triplet state by looking at the subpopulation and seeing how that changes as a function of the magnetic field. Yes?
So we use magnetic field to couple T1 plus T1.
Yes, this one. That's the goal. So DC magnetic field splits it up because otherwise AC magnetic field cannot couple. So you first need to the DC to split it up and then AC magnetic field will start coupling.
Yeah, but we said in the experiment we use DC only for this.
No, no, we always use. Look at the slide and then later on.
Okay.
Of course, you need AC. Otherwise, how are we going to get a resonance? But you don't detect resonance. You just look at the DC value where the resonance occurred. Because the resonance frequency is fixed. All right. So now, let me bring you back to that discussion we had before. So this approach, the way I explained to you, this is used, it has last 10 years or so, a lot of people are using it for large system. Electrical engineers these days are not interested in large capacitors, large systems. You have one or two defects or five defects. And if the question is, can you use this technique in there? And that will be very difficult. You can see if you have one is either occupied or not occupied. In that case, how do you do it? It turns out that the spin-dependent recombination changes the noise spectra. Noise was what? Coming in, getting out, coming in, getting out. And this spectra dependent on whether you could go in or get out easily. If you change that ratio by tuning the magnetic field, then what will happen? The spectra will change. And some of the most beautiful experiments have come out. Let me explain how it works. You remember that in these days, transistors are small. And so even if you had a 10 to the power 17 defect density, then you may have one or no defects at all. And the question is, then in that case, you can describe the probability that you will find one, two, or three just simply by Poisson relationship. And I said that when you had many, then you could look at 1 over F noise. And we did a quick derivation. And when you had few, 1 or... If you had nothing, then of course there's nothing. But when you have few, what happens? Electron goes in, changes the charge. That suppresses the current. And then the level goes down. And when it's empty, then it goes up. And so from there, you can calculate how many defects you have, what are the time constants associated with it. But this will not tell you whether it's a PB center. It will not tell you whether it is a E prime center, silicon center. You cannot tell it from here. It's one defect. That's all you know. But you will be able to tell it from the other experiment. So just to remind you again that how this spectra came about, it came about because when the level was filled, in that case, it essentially blocked the channel current, and the channel current correspondingly gave you the statistics. We discussed the statistics associated with it. And from that, we can calculate the number of defects you have and also the capture and the emission time constants, because you have to fit the statistics using the various capture times that are involved. So in the presence of magnetic field, how does things differ? That's what I want to explain to you. So this is a recent paper. The original theory was the reference on the left, but this paper I think came about in 2009 or 2010. Look at that top figure. In the top figure, you have the channel from the source to drain, and you have one broken bond. And that spin, you can see spin is looking horizontal to the channel. One preview center. And often these days, you will have something similar in the flash memories, that things are so small. There are one or two defects is all that you have. So now, I'll show you in the next slide all the details, but let's get the idea. On the left-hand side, I have a picture where I have the Fermi level of the channel. You can change this Fermi level of the channel by various ways. You can use the back gate, or you can change the source drain potential, and thereby change the channel level. Now, let's say you change it, keep changing it, until it sits in the middle of the PV center. Now, if it were alone, if there is no splitting, without a magnetic field, there is no splitting, the level, only the bottom level is relevant. And the bottom level most of the time be filled, or it can go in and come out normal noise spectra. However, if you have a magnetic field, it will split it, just like the splitting I talked to you about, right, a few minutes ago. It will split it. And now what can happen, that electron can come in here. When it is in resonance, when it's resonance, electron can go from the bottom to the top. Now it's free to go back. Its emission probability has increased considerably because it has been pumped up to a level above the Fermi level. And so now it can jump down. So at this point, you still see the capture rate increasing, the emission rate increasing dramatically when the resonance occurs. And just by looking at what magnetic field, DC magnetic field you had to put in order for this cycling to go on. This is like a magnetic field induced charge pumping. Do you understand this? That essentially, if you think about it, it's like a valence band and a conduction band, as if that electron has been pumped up and then transferred back to the channel. And then, therefore, that allows another electron to come in. So that changes the statistics. And from that statistical change, you can say what type of defects is really involved in such a system. You get the basic idea, right? So now let me show you how people do it. Let's say the original data is like that on the top left side. You can look at the current. The current is on the order of a fraction of a microamp. That's not a problem. And you are sitting, you have one sample, and you are recording this in terms of, what is this, STO, or this storage oscilloscope. Then you are, and this you can see, it's just a few milliseconds you have recorded this. Now, if you stop there, it looks very crazy, but there is a special algorithm to clean the data. And I will post that algorithm because you should know how to clean data. It detects the peaks in a special way. It's a very special statistical algorithm needed in order to take that raw data and generate in a statistical sample. Then, you look at the spectra, that how long it was down, when will it be down? When both the levels are trapped, right? When one electron is here, still hasn't gone back, and the other electron has already come in, you have two electrons, it will shut the channel. In here, you have one electron, so it will shut the channel a little less. And from that change in the channel conductance, you are really doing the channel conductance change. In that, from that, the current will go from zero. Zero meaning that it's a reference zero. Current is not zero. Zero is a reference zero. It will go between, jump between the two levels. And from the change in the statistics, you can say, so this is from this, you'll write a MATLAB code that gives you this distribution, that how long it was in one level versus the other level. So this would be singly occupied. When singly occupied, the current is more, you see? And when it's doubly occupied, two electrons both occupied, in that case, current will be a little bit less. And this level, this difference, essentially, relay correlates to a magnetic field when the resonance occurs. And from that, you can find out the characteristics of a single PV center. Just think about it. I mean, I cannot still think that there's anything more precise than this type of measurement in the entire physics community, being able to detect a single defect in a sea of material. Now, as I said, I keep cheating even in this level. This is not really the data. That's not how it works. The data is like that. So what you do, you sweep the gate voltage, right? So remember I said the Fermi level has to be moved up. So either you do it by changing the body voltage or change the gate voltage. So the Fermi level is pushed down through the defect level. And then once you do that, you can see that there are a set of combs looking down. And do you see the x-axis goes from what? 650 millivolts to 740 millivolts. Very small change. So we are talking about tiny changes in here.
But is the transistor off or on in this?
The transistor? You can see that the current level, the transistor is generally on. But it's a very small transistor. So essentially, but the point is that that's not what you need. At any point, what you need to see, I'll show you what it is. So you see there are three levels. The blue one is when the transistor is generally off. So in that case, the current is a little bit more. But it is occupied. Both levels are below Fermi level, so both are always occupied. Not because of the magnetic field, but simply because they are both below the Fermi level. So they are occupied, so you have a little bit more current. The bottom one, which is the blue, on the lowest of the parallel lines, that one is when both the Fermi levels are above. In that case, you don't have any charge. So the current is going through. And then in between is where you have electrons, which is right in the middle, where the electrons can get in and get out. You look at the region B and plot the statistics by subtracting out the current, because as you change the gate voltage, of course the channel electron number is changing, so therefore there's a linear increase in the current. You subtract that background, only then you will get a signal like this. And from that signal, you get the statistics. So this is it takes a few steps, but at the end of the day, this is the most precise measurement system that are available. And of course, in the general noise case, noise has become a big tool. Now even in industry in various places, you can either have before degradation, after degradation, depending on whether you have generated acceptor-like states or donor-like states, you can just use noise as a spectroscopy in general. This is easy, doesn't require any magnetic field. But the other one requires a magnetic field, but could be very, very precise. So let me conclude then. I hope I have been able to explain the essential difference between electron spin resonance, which catches everything, and therefore tells you practically nothing about electrical relevance of those measurements. But SDR is very powerful. This was first done in 1972. Again, 1972 to 1984, there was a series of, 78, series of papers, all with wrong interpretation. People knew experimentally that they could control Shockley-Dedal as a knob, but the physics of singlet triplet was not well established. People didn't understand it then. So it took another, only around 2002, 2003, people have converged to a conclusion that of this type of defect, defect dynamics is what's behind this process. Now, this SDR and ESR, what I said that many times people will use both in tandem so that this gives you independent signature, because ESR is an older technique. Lot of physicists, especially the Russians, are very good at this type of high precision measurement, and so therefore if you combine them you get the best information out. Now the setup is complex, and so therefore unless you are in a lab, big national lab, or in a, even in a university like this setup, in a day to day, if you are in XYZ company, chances are that if you ask it, they will say, okay, you stay in the company or don't do the measurement, or I can fire you and get the equipment. Both cannot be done at the same time. It's very expensive. That's what I'm saying. It's close to about, I'll say, close to $500,000 for the whole setup. And my bottom line is, at the end of the day, you cannot use one. You should be using charge pumping, DCIV. These days, these are all routines that comes with the equipment. Once you set it up, the switch matrix and other things, once you set it up, this is done. Most people are afraid because they don't know the physics. Because if you know the physics, the setup is something that even I can do. So therefore, it should not be too difficult. But try to use, that is the general rule, the classical tools. The more advanced one is only should be as a backup, not that the primary day-to-day tool. Okay, just one second. So I have a set of references. As I said, there's nothing, no books or anything on this topic. So I just read it from various places and tried to summarize for you in a simple way. And then this is sort of some of the references that you can look into. You don't have to read them all. Try to see whether you can understand the argument that I had, because the history otherwise is quite complicated.